Hello, everyone, and thanks for hanging out with us for the Behind the Numbers Weekly Listen, an eMarketer podcast made possible by Smartly.io. This is the first Friday show of 2022 that covers the most startling media news stories of the week. I'm your host, Marcus Johnson. In today's show, secret predictions for 2022.
So really, if Spotify's podcast video content can find success, then there are endless possibilities for them to expand outside of that. So I think that one prediction for me is tapping the creator economy for Spotify to get more into video.
A new form of conversational commerce.
I can definitely see, you know, for directions or, I mean, for a lot of the things we currently use, voice-assisted technologies, but I just don't see commerce being the first in line.
The copycats came for Clubhouse.
It was much more ripe for co-opting on other platforms. It wasn't novel enough to propel a platform like Clubhouse from infancy into a major player.
Big tech shareholders demand internal audits, a digital butler for your car, and what are some tricks to help you maintain your New Year's resolutions? All right, folks, joining me for this very first weekly listen of 2022, we have three people. Let's meet them. Some familiar voices for you for today's episode. We start with our principal analyst who heads up our advertising and media practice. You know him as Paul Werner.
Great to be here. Happy New Year, everyone.
Hey, chap. Thanks for hanging out. Happy New Year back at you. We're also joined by one of our analysts on the retail and e-commerce team. It's Blake Drosch.
Hey, everyone. Happy New Year.
There he is. Happy New Year to him, too. And finally, we have one of our senior forecasting analysts. It's Peter Varley.
Hey, Marcus. And I'd be rude if I didn't wish everyone else a Happy New Year.
I know. It'd be awkward, wouldn't it? It'd be proper awkward if you were like, hi, everyone.
I guess we set a high bar.
Nothing else to add. Yeah.
Today's the last day that you can wish anyone a Happy New Year. After tomorrow,
that's it.
You get fined.
It gets weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
You get a fine. Is that what you said?
New law.
What do we have in store for you today? Well, four segments as per usual. We start with the story of the week. Secret predictions for 2022. What are our analysts thinking? Are some predictions they've been thinking to themselves that they maybe haven't said out loud up until this point? We then move to the game of the week, What's the Point, where our contestants go head-to-head-to-head, and they give us the best takeaways they can from each of the four stories we have for you to win the championship belt. We then move to Working From Somewhere. This is going to be the last time we do the segment Working From Somewhere. We've got a new segment for you next week, but we're talking about Working From Somewhere this week for the final time, and then Dinner Party Data is how we round off every weekly listen show. We start with the story of the week, secret predictions for 2022. For all the things that did happen last year, a lot didn't end up materializing. Our eMarketer briefing newsletter notes that consumers didn't get a federal privacy law they wanted in 2021. Social commerce made strides, but in-app checkout still leaves pretty much everything to be desired. And virtual events were just okay. But what about this year? What are we expecting to take place in 2022? Well, some of our official predictions inside our Top 10 Trends of 2022 report predict the arrival of viral commerce, retail media to go mainstream, nano and micro influencers having their moments. Some predictions coming out of this year's Consumer Electronics Show anticipate sensor-assisted bathtubs that maintain consistent water temperature, or AI-equipped baby monitors that can detect a covered face. Other predictions from around the internet include US inflation averaging under 3%, or that Norway will win the most medals at the upcoming 2022 Winter Olympics. But what are some predictions our analysts have been thinking about in secret? Gents, I'll start with Blake. Blake, lots of predictions happening at this moment. We're doing a bunch of trends episodes ourselves. We've done a couple already. We'll have more for you in the worlds of social video, retail, et cetera, et cetera. But what are some predictions or a prediction you've been thinking about, but you haven't said out loud yet?
So yeah, something that I haven't really said out loud because I feel like it's sort of blasphemous in this space. I've been going through all of the other media outlets, including our own, and looking at all of the predictions for this year. And all of them, probably to nobody's surprise, has some sort of prediction around the metaverse and what's going to be happening in the metaverse this year. And my prediction is going to be that if you decided to read absolutely nothing about the metaverse for all of 2022 and come back here on January 4th, 2023, it would take you about maybe 2 or 3 minutes to get caught up on everything that's going to happen in terms of the advancements of the metaverse this year. 2022 is not going to be the year of the metaverse. I think that, you know, all of the statistics gauging consumer interest are all showing there's very, very little interest. And yes, there was a bump in downloads for the Facebook Oculus app, presumably after a lot of people were gifted the headsets for Christmas, but that's sort of being the best case example that's being touted right now is sort of any momentum that Meta or any other metaverse organization is getting right now. And I think, you know, I'm not entirely out on the idea of the metaverse at all. I just think that it's something that's gotten a lot of hype over the last couple of months, and I don't think that we're going to see too much in terms of groundbreaking momentum for any type of metaverse in 2022 at all.
So it's probably a great time to tell you guys that we've got a metaverse residency that we're going to be doing on the podcast.
A couple of times a month,
myself and Andrew Lipsman, maybe a few other folks, will be talking about the metaverse, just keep you up to date with the latest information, which you do not need to hear, apparently.
Because Andrew and I talk about the metaverse all the time, and we tend to take the same sort of tempered approach to gauging the metaverse. And Andrew is actually speaks about it much more eloquently than I do. So I think that is totally worthwhile endeavor, and I look forward to listening to those episodes myself.
Yeah, you're not wrong. There's going to be a lot of talk about it, and there's lots to talk about, but realistically, there's really no moves to be made. It seems to be a lot of the consensus at this point. When it comes to the metaverse, Blake, is there something that you think is holding it back more so than anything else?
There are so many things. I don't know where to begin, but I would definitely say that there's just really no practical use for us right now that is going to be able to generate widespread mm-hmm. consumer interest in any facet of it currently.
Yeah, it's fair. It's absolutely fair prediction. All right, let's get some more. Peter, how about you?
So my prediction falls under our digital audio coverage. And my prediction is that while Spotify will continue to expand its lead over Apple in the podcast arena, my big prediction for 2022 is that Spotify will make a serious play for video and connected TV time by tapping into the creator economy. For a while now, Spotify has published some video podcasts for select creators such as Joe Rogan. But recently, Spotify announced that they will allow all creators that upload podcasts through Anchor to also include a video component. And Anchor is Spotify's podcast hosting service. So why is this a big deal? Because 80% of Spotify's podcasts come from independent creators on Anchor. And that means that 80% of podcast creators can now upload video podcasts on Spotify. And why is this promising? Mainly because there's a strong parallel to YouTube here in my mind. YouTube is the biggest ad-supported service on CTV, and they've been able to monetize content from these independent creators for a long time now, as we all know. And that is now translating to success on big television screens. So I think Spotify will eventually try to replicate YouTube's success on CTV by housing a large library of independent podcast videos. The main difference here between Spotify and YouTube really is that Spotify is taking an audio first or podcast first approach, whereas YouTube is a native video platform. That's where they, you know, that's how they started. So that's truly part of their DNA. So really, if Spotify's podcast video content can find success, then there are endless possibilities for them to expand outside of that. So I think that one prediction for me is tapping the creator economy for Spotify to get more into video.
And what's your position on video podcasts, Peter? Just in general, and also a follow-up question from that would be, when, if at all, should we be paying attention to video podcasts?
I think that video podcasts will certainly be a big thing. They have been for a long time on YouTube, but they've sort of been lost in YouTube's huge sea of content. And as a video first platform, it's not the best place for people who want to get an audio first listening experience on the go. So I think it really will actually take something like Spotify or maybe another audio first service to really take the lead and make video podcasts popular for a really wide audience. So I do think there is a need for it. I do think that there's a lot of interest and a lot of demand, but I think another key is making it really easy for people to toggle the video component on and off. Because I think, you know, you might want to be listening to something on the go and you stop for a couple minutes and you want to easily turn the video on and then you go again and you want to turn it back off. So I think that will really be the key, because I don't think there's anyone who wants video all the time or anyone who would want video absolutely none of the time.
Yeah, great points. Paul, let's take a final prediction from you.
Yeah, I was going to go to the place where Blake went, the metaverse, and cast also kind of a skeptical look at it, and maybe save our audience the trouble of even bothering with those residencies you're going to do, Marcus. I would say just, I'm kidding. Appreciate about that. That last part, of course. Everything you ever say on this podcast is worth tuning into and repeat listening.
But, so true, but thanks.
But you know what I'll do is I'll make a little comment on both of those predictions. I think I think there's actually a through line there. With the metaverse, I think it will become a real thing when it can be mainstream. And I think for that to happen, we have to move away from like bulky headsets and into something much more streamlined and much more just easy to use. And the analogy is maybe like the early cell phones that were like the size of a briefcase versus now. So I think when that happens, we will all be much more able to tune into all of the things that the metaverse can offer. But I don't think this is going to be the year of that, despite all of the headlines, to Blake's point. Mm-hmm. I think with video podcasts, I see them as a celebrity-driven genre, not so much a mainstream thing, because part of the beauty of podcasting is you can listen on the go. You can, you know, listen while you're working out or washing the dishes or going out for a walk or commuting. And those are all times and places where it just doesn't really make sense to watch video. Now, that said, there are definitely podcasts where, you know, you really want to almost watch them as you would watch like a talk show or something. And for that, yes, I think what Spotify is doing this year and what YouTube has been doing, and certainly I'm sure Amazon will not be long to follow in those footsteps, I think that will become a thing. So I do think that Spotify is going to try to get in on that action. But I don't see podcasting overall evolving into a video first way of accessing media, because it's just not practical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. There's some predictions for you. Some secret predictions for 2022. I've got a couple for you. One, the Packers will win the Super Bowl. Two, the Warriors will win the NBA championship. Number three, no one cares about baseball. And number four, France will win the World Cup. All right. Let's move on. Time now for the game of the week. But first, quick word from our sponsor, Smartly.io. Hi to all the social media marketers out there. Listen up. Social platforms have become more important than ever for brands. You know this. So if you're looking to scale your social advertising in 2022, look no further. Smartly.io is number one in social media advertising. They help brands automate every step of the process by combining creative production and ad buying to unlock greater performance. All right, folks, we are back. It's time now for the game of the week. Today's game, a new game. I'm kidding. Same game we always play. What's the point? Where we read out four stories and have contestants Paul, Blake, and Peter tell us what they think is the main takeaway of the story. Okay answers get 1 point. Good answers get two. And that feeling when someone's leaving a parking spot right in front of the place that you're going, so you pull right in, answers that give you that feeling, they get you 3 points.
It's a good feeling.
Such a good feeling. Each person gets 20 seconds to answer before they hear this. Whoever has the most points after four rounds wins and gets the last word. We start with Blake. A new form of conversational commerce is our first round. Startups are increasingly experimenting with how sales, interactions, and transactions can be conducted entirely within text messaging chat windows, writes Patrick Culp of Adweek. He notes that conversational commerce startup Wizard, backed by former Walmart e-commerce chief Mark Laurie, recently raised $50 million to try and provide brands with an end-to-end service that lets them conduct transactions over text. Mr. Culp writes that advances in AI natural language processing make interactions on this scale more viable, as well as a general shift in e-commerce. Blake, a new form of conversational commerce, what's the point?
I think it's definitely one way to reduce friction, but it seems to be a real challenge to develop a realistic AI chatbot, and that's been something that's been going on for a while. Plus all of this back-end logistics stuff that seem to be very difficult hurdles, and it just sort of begs the question to me, is it really worth it putting in this investment? Because at the end of the day, it's not going to be something that is going to revolutionize shopping. It's going to be a utility or an additional avenue, but it just seems like it's a massive investment for just one more lane.
Peter,
Yeah, I agree. It reminds me a little bit of WhatsApp Business, which allows small businesses to directly communicate with users and conduct transactions via text messages. But I think ultimately, this market is all about who owns the messaging rails. So other than WhatsApp, it would be iMessage, Android, and Facebook Messenger. And the owner of those services will be the ones who ultimately scale text commerce in sort of whatever way they end up doing it.
Paul.
Yeah, I mean, I could see messaging evolving to where voice is a utility in a lot of everyday situations, but I think commerce is probably not going to be the highest priority. I mean, I just can't see like driving around and saying, you know, buy me that used car. You know, it's like, it's, I don't know. I can definitely see, you know, for directions or I mean, for a lot of the things we currently use voice assisted technologies, but I just don't see commerce being the first in line.
According to Mike Meyer, CEO and founder of conversational AI startup Quick, the biggest obstacle with true end-to-end conversational commerce transactions is integrating payment providers into messaging. Move to our second round. We start with Peter. The copycats came for Clubhouse. The New York Times' Kate Conger notes lots of people started the year hosting their conversations on social audio app Clubhouse, but finished the year on Twitter Spaces or any one of the other copycat platforms. Clubhouse downloads fell off last spring, according to analytics company Sensor Tower, as lockdowns relaxed and new competition emerged. Downloads picked up, though, over the summer and registered nearly 2 million in November. Clubhouse was expecting even more downloads in December. And the company says about 700,000 conversations are created on Clubhouse every day. That's twice as many as this past summer. And also, the average user spends about 1 hour and 10 minutes a day on the app. Peter, the copycats came for Clubhouse. What's the point?
At the end of the day, creators want audience scale. And that's much easier to find on Twitter, Facebook, or even Spotify, all of which now have their own social audio, live audio, whatever you want to call it. So Clubhouse really has their work cut out for them to prove that they're not just a pandemic fad and that they actually can continue to attract listeners to this new form of entertainment, you know, and keep them away from these other really popular established services.
Paul.
Yeah, I mean, I think to Peter's point, you know, Clubhouse essentially pioneered a new paradigm, but it works better as a feature than as a standalone business. And that's why companies like Twitter and others have essentially absorbed it and worked it into their core offerings.
Blake.
Yeah, exactly. I think the feature just wasn't strong enough to sustain an entire platform. It was, you know, really social audio. All it is just sort of a in between a live stream and a podcast, and it was much more ripe for co-opting on other platforms. It wasn't novel enough to propel a platform like Clubhouse from infancy into a major player.
Yeah, so to both your points there, but or all your points there, but Paul, you said works better as a feature than a standalone service. Ashley Carmen of The Verge thinks that a dating app, not Facebook or Clubhouse, I guess Twitter, whoever, cracked getting audio to go viral. She's talking about Hinge allowing daters to add voice prompts to their profiles so you can tell potential matches about yourself with a 30-second clip of your voice. Hinge said that 2/3 of daters it polled said voice would help them better determine chemistry. So maybe, yeah, it will be a feature, which I think is some of our analysts had said last year, were more likely to be a feature of other platforms than a standalone platform.
I guess if you're trying to sell yourself in a dating service, then maybe that's a form of conversational commerce.
Extra points. Well played. We move to our third round. We start with that very man. We start with Paul. Big tech shareholders demand internal audits. A group of Meta, Facebook, shareholders, along with the Campaign for Accountability, has submitted a resolution calling for an independent evaluation of the board's ability to oversee public safety on Facebook's platforms, notes Joanne Muller of Axios. Meanwhile, Amazon's shareholders are calling for an independent audit of how the company treats workers with regards to Amazon's productivity quotas and surveillance practices, writes Kim Lyons of The Verge. So, Paul, big tech shareholders demanding internal audit, specifically in this case, Meta and Amazon. What's the point?
This reminds me a little bit of the independent review board that Facebook launched. I don't know if it was last year or the year before, where, you know, it's well-intentioned, but the fact that the people who are running it are people who are gaining financially from the performance of the company, just suggests to me that they're going to end up following the money and that this might end up just being posturing, or that it really won't have a lot of chances to make a difference in these companies' business practices.
Blake.
Yeah, you know, I think that these shareholders want to protect their investments, but the story here is figuring out a way to spin this bad public image, as Paul alluded to, and basically put some sort of control on it so it doesn't eventually affect their stock price down the line. And we have to obviously view that separately from the actual issues and the potential damage that they have to do, because it's basically just it's just image control coming from a different facet of these organizations.
Peter.
This one was really interesting for me, and I'm going to just focus quickly on the Facebook side of it, because I think Facebook, or Meta, the company, and these shareholders who are proposing this resolution, they want the same thing overall, which is internet regulation that takes responsibility away from Facebook or Meta and gives it to the government or some overarching body that is policing the internet. So I think ultimately both parties would be satisfied with a solution that takes the responsibility away from Meta.
We move to our final round, a digital butler for your car. Your next car might well be able to read your mind, offering suggestions of where to go and what to do before you even ask it, writes Joanne Muller of Axios. Vehicle voice recognition company Corence is showing off its intuitive AI-powered driving companion at CES this year that's designed to anticipate your needs. So, for example, your car might suggest ordering and paying for a cup of coffee when the driver is a mile from their favorite coffee shop. It could recognize a maintenance issue and offer to set up a service appointment. Knowing you had a meeting 50 miles away tomorrow morning, Copilot could suggest stopping for fuel today before the low fuel warning light comes on. Or it could even deliver real-time information such as severe weather approaching and offer to put the car into the appropriate driving mode, Miss Muller writes. We'll start with Blake on this one. A digital butler in your car, what's the point?
Yeah, connected car technology is something that's been talked about and developed for a long time, and you know, for the over several years. And there are a lot of vendors sort of vying for control of this space. But I really think that a company that really has the best chance here is a company like Apple, which already has a lot of control over the smart home market. And the connected car market is really sort of that next evolution. And you have to think that consumers who are going to be the first adopters for this type of connected car technology are going to want to have it within the same ecosystem of how they connect their smart home technology. So I think that that is a logical next evolution. And I've always been looking sort of to see who's running the smart home world to sort of get a little bit of foresight into how that's going to eventually incorporate the car, not be something separate from it.
Peter.
Yeah, it's reports like this one, I think, that make a lot of people excited about connected cars, but also make a lot of people make a connection between Apple and cars and the future of you know, Apple's ambitions to create a car, because there are so many synergies and a lot of the things that Apple is doing with their own technology. You know, just to give a quick example, I get suggestions on my phone to check the weather at times of the day where I usually check the weather in the past, or to a reminder to set the alarm before I go to bed. These things where they're already anticipating my behavior and suggesting that I do something. And that's kind of what the gist of this article is about. So I think as the evolution of things like the smartphone go on, that is also going to happen in cars.
Paul. I agree about Apple's potential role in connected car development and technology, but the biggest takeaway for me is that if I had a car that had a digital butler, I would have to disable that feature because my real butler would get jealous. I could never do that to him or them, because it's a whole staff.
That's what we've got time for the game of the week. This week's winner, a drum roll, and it keeps going for an inappropriate amount of time. Peter is this week's winner of the game of the week. Congratulations to Peter. It was close. Blake, great answer at the end there. Came very close. But Peter edged him out. to win this week's Game of the Week. The first Game of the Week in 2022. Peter, congratulations.
Thank you, Marcus. And I thought Paul was going to get it with that last Butler joke. I thought Paul was right on the money with some of his responses, short and sweet, especially filling in last minute. I was quite impressed.
You know, jokes get you audience points, but not real points.
Yeah. I have no time for that.
That's the problem.
Is this like the critic score versus the audience score? Do we have one of those? Do we keep any metrics on that?
Peter, you get the last word. 30 seconds of airtime to tell us anything you want to tell us.
Well, I was just going to go back to the feeling of when you get a parking spot right when someone's pulling out.
Yeah,
just so good. Because it's really satisfying, and just wanted to share that it happened to me the other night, like a week ago. I think it was actually New Year's Eve, and I was going to get groceries, you know, time crunch like it always is New Year's Eve or any holiday, and was pulling in, and right then and there, car coming out, took the spot. And I don't want to say I fist pumped, but there was sort of this this audible celebration, which made me feel really pathetic. And now that I'm sharing it here on the podcast, it's even more pathetic. But, you know, when you don't have much to say, it's these little moments.
So good. So
especially
good.
In New York.
Thank you. Yeah.
She's like, yes. I like to think you did one of those things from like any movie basically like in the early 90s where you would like jump and punch the air and like freeze frame and then it'll be the end of the film.
Right down.
80s? Further back?
Breakfast 80s. Club, man. The 80s.
There we are. There we are. You know what I'm talking about, Blake. Anyway, so we've got time for the Game of the Week. Congratulations to Peter. He won this week's Game of the Week and holds onto the championship belt. Until next week when we play again. But for now, it's time for Working From Somewhere. This is the segment of the show where we discuss what it's like to be working in this new hybrid work world. We're going to be listening into a conversation I had earlier this week with Jennifer, Marissa and Victoria, who all work at Insider Intelligence, about how the hybrid working world has affected women in the workplace. Today, we are joined by three other folks who aren't on the full episode of the Weekly Listen. We have some very important guests for today's episode. We have joining us Jennifer Pearson, who is our VP of Research.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hey there, Jenny. Thank you so much for hanging out. We're also joined by Marissa Kozlov, who is also Vice President here at Insider Intelligence.
Hey, Marcus.
Hey, Marissa. Good to have you back on as well. And finally, we have... You know her as Victoria, but her full name is Victoria Grace. She is the associate producer of podcasts for the Content Studio, who edits all of the podcasts and who sometimes laughs in the background or has comments about food and movies and TV shows whilst we're talking live on the recording. So, Victoria, welcome to the podcast on this side of the mic.
Hi, guys. This is strange, but I'm happy to be here.
There she is. Finally, we've got her in front of the mic. So, they're the three people we have for you, Jenny, Marissa, and Victoria. And we're talking about how the hybrid working world has affected women in the workplace. There have been different problems cropping up for different kinds of people in this new hybrid world of work. Today, we want to look specifically at the problems facing women and also mothers as well. And Vanessa Fermans and Lauren Weber of the Wall Street Journal note that the pandemic has been especially brutal for women. They suffered a disproportionate number of layoffs, took on more home responsibilities, and made more career sacrifices to manage the collapse of in-school learning and childcare arrangements, research shows. And Rani Moller of Recode put some numbers on that. She notes that in 2020, 3 million women dropped out of the workforce. 1.6 million had still not returned as of August 2021. And so we have these ladies here joining us today to talk about some of their experiences with this new hybrid world of work. Jenny, I'll come to you first. A couple of ways the pandemic-induced shift to hybrid work has affected you the most.
Sure. And I can go kind of chronologically. In 2020, it was pretty starkly different than my experience right now. In 2020, I have a six-year-old. He was learning remotely.
Six?
He's six. He'll be seven.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, he won't. No, he won't. Someone's counted wrong.
I know. I think he was two when we started these podcasts.
He was two last year. Okay. What's going on?
Right. So 2020, and I'm sure a lot of parents and women have this similar experience, was pretty rough. I have a vivid memory of being in a very large content sales meeting with the door shut, and I could see my son's fingers under the door trying to get to me. So that was really a tough balance. Oh. And I'm sure there are still parents and moms and parents going through this right now. But my year this year, I feel, is different. My son is back in school full time in person, and I have an odd kind of paradox in that I'm more available for him for a winter concert I attended a couple of weeks ago in the middle of the day that would have caused a lot of stress to get home from commute wise and that type of thing. So it's an interesting where I'm able to devote more work hours to work, but also balance that time with him also.
Right. So on that point, so there's some research from Nicholas Bloom of Stanford University and colleagues. 32% of college educated American women with children want to work remotely full time, 32%, versus 23% of comparable men. But a female writer of The Economist's Badgett column notes that relinquishing the daily banter among colleagues, many of whom double as friends, could have long-term damages. What's been your opinion on how much you want to go back in the office versus being able to stay at home and kind of really share those valuable moments with your son?
Oh, yeah, I don't know. And Marissa, I've been back to the office a few times, and gosh, I'm very happy to see Marissa there and talk about our kids. And I do miss that. So it's tough to find the right balance. And I like that we have the hybrid approach. But I don't know, Marissa, I don't know if you have a different take because you're in the office more than I am.
Right. I was going to say for our listeners, you obviously can't see me right now, but I'm in the office and I have been working out of the office since September of 2020. The very first day that it was available to us to come back here, I was back in the office because it is so much more effective for me to work here. But there are clearly downsides now of being in the office because a lot of time I'm here by myself. So it's a completely different vibe. And I also work on sales side, and sales just feeds off of so much energy and people around you and people cheering and hearing people on the phone with their clients or just joining calls. Now, instead of, I always would say to a former coworker who used to sit next to me, I can't just turn to my left and ask you a question. I have to schedule time with you, or I have to look at your calendar to see if you're available. I can't just have a quick pop over to your desk and ask you something. Right. So that has definitely been different. But for me, it has been great to be able to access our office and be here, even if there's only a handful of people, you know, 1% of our company coming here every day.
Thinking about kind of pushing out long term is probably generous, but I guess maybe short term, thinking about the rest of this year. I mean, is there a threshold for you in terms of, you know, I'd like to get the number of people up in the office up to about 20-30%, and then it'll be worthwhile you coming in long term? Or like, will you be able to sustain or want to keep going into the office if it's just a handful of people compared to the hundreds we have working at the company?
I will come in here even if it's just me by myself. That's just me. That's how I work. I love just leaving my house in the morning. Mm-hmm. I can walk here, so that's very fortunate. But just to have that time where it's built-in exercise that I can walk to the office and have a separate space, it also allows me to separate that home life and work life, which now I know has been so challenging for so many people who they never can disconnect because their computer and their laptop is open right next to them at their kitchen table where they're also eating all of their meals. I mean, Victoria, I think you started a day before our office shut down. So your entire employment here has been remote. That must be interesting for you also.
Thank you so much for pointing out because it's been weird. It's been really strange.
I remember meeting you on that very first day and saying, well, I don't know when I'll see you again.
And I remember the first time I came back to the office after things kind of calmed down a little bit. You were the first person I saw when I walked in too. So it was nice because I did get to see like a familiar face that I knew in person. But yeah, as Marissa mentioned, I started in March 2020. I was in the office for one day. I did all of my onboarding paperwork. I was promptly handed a laptop and said, go home. We'll see you in a week. And in the back of my mind, I'm like, I just started this job. I'm going to get laid off. This is horrible. Like, it's so much anxiety, especially when there's a certain level of anxiety I think everybody has when you start a new job to begin with. And it was strange to not only adjust to working from home, but adjust to working from home with people who I didn't have working relationships with. You know, you build up so much time at a specific company, you kind of get embedded into the culture of that company, you find the best methods that work for everybody to work, you know, harmoniously and all that stuff. And then all of those coping mechanisms that you instinctively know how to enact in your own professional life, they're suddenly wiped away. And you're like, well, what am I supposed to do now? And I mean, I think I differ from Jenny and Marissa in the fact that I don't have children. I like to consider myself a young professional. I'm not going to say that too loud because I have a sister who's much younger working in a couple rooms over.
Victoria. You're so young. It's painful.
But like from a career standpoint, it's a completely different ball game. And like, I can't even imagine having to deal with an early mid-career transition to remote plus having the responsibility of children or a partner or taking care of aging parents or aging relatives or stuff like that. And a lot of times that does fall mainly on women's shoulders.
Yeah.
Well, that's also one thing, Marcus. You sent us a few articles prior to our conversation today about just how it's impacted moms and women and anybody who's a caretaker for somebody like Victoria just mentioned. And I think the element of self-care is something that has become so much harder now. Like for moms and women, I think in general, always feel that you have to be doing everything. You have to be everything to all people. And that's just part of the game. And pre-pandemic, it was already hard enough to take time for yourself. But now I find, even earlier, Marcus, you asked me before we started recording, what did I do on my day off on Monday? Well, there really is nothing to do. Like, so it becomes so much harder to even take time off because things that you maybe did for fun previously for self-care, maybe you went to the spa, maybe you, you know, did manicure, pedicure, or you went to a new gym studio. Like, you probably don't feel comfortable doing those things anymore. Mm-hmm. So it becomes even harder. And then you want to focus on your kids and making sure they're okay and entertained and feel, you know, like appreciated and you're paying attention to them. It just, the time for yourself really has to become such a priority now. Yeah. And you really have to make sure that you are taking that time.
What have any of you been doing to try and to grab a little bit of respite here or there? Are there new routines that you've formed, new activities you've tried to take on, new ways of trying to actually, you know, grasp at a few moments of relaxation or rest, recuperation, whatever you want to call it when you can?
I've been trying to get out and run or jog or walk to get outside because it's pretty easy to stay in all the time working from home. And then, of course, exercise that's needed and alone time. It's some of the only time I have solitary time. So that's nice.
Okay. Anyone else?
Yeah, I will say the alone time for me happens early, before the sun even comes up. 5 o'clock in the morning is my time, which I'm sure every time I tell that to somebody, they think I'm absolutely insane. But that's when I wake up, I do a gym class, you know, I take a Pilates class, and then I read a book for pleasure for 20 minutes. And this all happens before 6:20 in the morning, which is then when I get in the shower and then come to the office. But yeah, I know at that time, nobody's awake in my apartment. It's completely quiet. And that's just my time. And if that has to happen at 5 o'clock in the morning, that's when it's going to happen.
Yep.
That's a big no from me. 5 a.m.?
Yeah.
God bless. Too much.
Victoria's face. She was horrified by that. Mm-hmm. Well, speaking about mental health. So yeah, some of the articles pointing to that as a big issue here. Rani Muller of Recode points out that mothers working from home during the pandemic reported higher rates of anxiety, depression, and loneliness than fathers. McKinsey & Company and Lean In's 7th annual Women in the Workplace study that surveys thousands of people showed women felt more burnt out than men. Women in the US, 50% more likely than men to say their mental health has declined in the past year, according to GWI and See Her, which is the initiative by the ANA to portray women and girls more accurately in marketing, media, and entertainment. Part of the thing that's exacerbated mental health concerns has been Zoom. And there was one article from Cheryl Winokur Monk of the Wall Street Journal looking at why Zoom fatigue is worse among women. And before we talk about that, I wanted to get your folks' opinions on how that's affected your relationship with work.
Those interactions that Marissa was talking about, just turning next to a team member or a colleague, have to be planned. And now we use Google Meet, a Zoom call. And so there is that just to interact, just to ask a question, just to get that human connection, we have to log into this service. And it is exhausting. Rather than just a quick turn and a quick interaction, it becomes a little lengthier and a little more involved. And I believe that Zoom fatigue is real.
Mm-hmm. It becomes a task attached to something that was effortless in the past.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of women are like, I got my list. This is everything that I have to get through today. And now scheduling a call becomes an item on your to-do list. And it also like takes a certain amount of joy out mm-hmm. of an interaction that you might have with a coworker or a person that you consider a friend at work or something like that. It becomes something that you have to do to stay on top of things, to make sure that your working relationship is solid instead of something that is very effortless when you're with that person sitting next to you 5 feet away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you lose so much of what you can observe from seeing somebody in real life or even the way that they have decorated their desks, the books that they have on their desks. Like if you come into the office, you'll see my desk has not changed for years, right? Because I've been sitting here the entire time, but everybody else's desks are bare because they don't come in anymore. So I have a lot of personality at my desk because that's my space. But when I see somebody on Zoom and they have a blank wall behind them, I have no idea about anything else in their surroundings, about their personality. And especially for all of these new coworkers that we have in the past 2 years, I only know them from the torso up for the most part. And it's just a really different way of getting to know people.
Yeah. You are hitting a nail on the head. I had so much panic and anxiety.
Victoria is freaking out so much about this.
Meeting people in real life for the first time, especially first time I met Stu, who runs the content studio. He started remote. I basically started remote. I knew him from the shoulders up, and I was losing my mind a little bit. It was spiraling for no reason. Like, a person is a person. But it's strange because you get to know somebody within like a 3x3 inch icon on your computer screen. And now you expect me to be completely fine with this person being a person? It's weird.
So true. Somebody said to me in the beginning, she said, "I'm so excited to come into the office because I want to see how tall you are." And I thought, wow, that never occurred to me that she wouldn't have a sense of how tall I was. And I told her, "You're going to be really disappointed because I am not that tall. I'm only 5'3". And she said, "Are you serious? I would never have guessed that." I thought, "What do you mean? Like, you only see this little square of me all the time."
Yeah. You give off taller energy than.
Oh, thank you. That's a good compliment. I like that. Yeah. Taller energy.
Yeah. 3D Stuart is way better than 2D Stuart. Mm-hmm. It's so much more interactive.
3D Marcus is better than 2D Marcus too, for what it's
Thanks.
Worth.
Thank you. I appreciate that. He's not, but cheers, V. I want to get your take on this study. So according to a study published in the Journal of Applied Psychology in August from Kristen M. Shockley, Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of Georgia, long title, she was saying women who tend to be judged more harshly, both in terms of their behavior and their appearance than men, are likely to spend more time thinking about how they look and focusing on whether they appear attentive enough on screen. This takes up greater cognitive resources and mental energy and ultimately is more tiring. Also, the likelihood of children interrupting, Jenny, to your point, is greater for women than men, which can cause anxiety. How much of a struggle has that been? Has it been, you know, a slight adjustment, a really severe adjustment?
I honed in on that. I actually wrote down cognitive resources and mental energy a little bit more for a different reason. Just, I think we bring a lot of that to, there's a lot going on in our lives and wanting to and managing a lot. So for that reason, but I haven't received too much of like comments on appearance or whatnot, but I have a couple of friends who have flagged it. A male colleague said she looked tired or just probably not appropriate. And I can understand why it could impact uniquely sometimes women.
Mm-hmm. I don't think this is a pandemic thing. I think this goes back many, many years of a different expectation for what women should be wearing versus what men should be wearing. I don't think that's a pandemic thing.
Mm-hmm. But this exacerbated it?
I think it's easier on Zoom, to be honest. I mean, right now, you have no clue what I'm wearing on the bottom right now. I could be wearing, you know, ripped up sweatpants. You have no idea. Yes. You only see me from the torso up. And and I think it's actually easier this way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Going back quickly to something Jenny, we were talking about do you want to go into the office, you know, longer term? Do you want to stay at home, trying to find that right balance? It is part of the answer, you know, I don't know. We'll see. And the fact that, you know, a lot of this can be seasonal. When the kids are in school, you know, then it'll be easier for me to get in. When they're not, it will be harder for me to. Sometimes my kids will be sick. I'd like to stay at home with them. Is the answer, you know, just question mark and being given the flexibility to adjust based on the time of year as well? Is that part of the answer?
I do think so. We're so fortunate that we have that flexibility and that, you know, the days I've gone in and saw Marissa in the office and spent time and made really good connections with my colleagues in person, I chose that and was able to do that. And then the days I know my son had the winter concert, I stayed home. I do think, I don't know the cadence going forward, and you know, we're so lucky to be able to choose that and purposefully and intentionally choose it. I know a lot aren't in that position, but I do think it's a question mark. Yeah.
Final question for me. What are some of your longer term concerns about the way that we're working at the moment? I mean, some people have adapted to the way things are now, but things likely won't stay this way. And there'll obviously be a constant state of flux going forward. What are some of your more longer term concerns?
There's 23 people on our team. I went in a couple of months back and realized some of the junior members of our team who had not been in the office yet I showed them the podcast studio, for example, and they were in awe. And in our, you know, where we do webinars, and I realized there was that bit of context missing in their onboarding training, the big picture of not being able to interact with you all and see that room and know how it connects to our media side of the business. So just I see as a long term in terms of managing a team and people who are missing certain context.
Yeah, it seems that though it's a lot easier for people to leave a company and also to get let go from a company because they have less of a relationship. And so if HR is cutting people, you know, they're just cutting a name more so than they're cutting that person they've known for 5 years, and vice versa. If you don't feel like you've got an attachment to the company, it might be easier to walk away after just a couple of months. So that's a really, really good point there, Jenny. Anyone else?
I do worry about the human element of communication, whereas when we were all in person together, of course, we would all see each other. We would be in meetings together. And when you're in this type of remote working world, it's really easy to hide behind the screen, to just turn your camera off and do other things. There's less accountability. So I do worry about people coming into the workforce now, coming out of college, and what their communication skills will be like, what they're learning, because right now, this is all they know of the working world. And I also think, you know, Jenny, to your point about people seeing the office, I feel like sometimes when people come in here, because I'm here most days, I feel like a tour guide when people come in. I have to show them where the bathroom is. I mean, there's obviously nobody sitting at the front desk. They're not sure where to go. And they see me and I end up showing them around, which is really nice because I do get to know people. But it's just very different when you are not physically around people, and the culture just has changed a lot at any company. There's definitely not the same culture that there was really anywhere.
It's changed. And how do you maintain it as well? How do you maintain that culture, or, you know, continue to make sure that there's a culture to come to and nourish that culture?
Yeah. And I think also with senior executives at the company who maybe previously were much more accessible to more junior employees now really are not at all, because I think for maybe a junior person or somebody who's, you know, maybe this is their second or third job out of school, would they just put time on the, you know, a senior executive's calendar now in the way in which we're working? Probably not. But would they say hi to them if they saw them in the kitchen or in the bathroom? Probably.
Yeah. Victoria, how about for you? Any hopes or concerns about this hybrid world of work kind of going forward?
I mean, I think the hope across the board, not even just like internally for us, is that everybody finds things in a hybrid work approach to make work easier. Because I think before the pandemic, I can speak for some of like my girlfriends, my friends who, you know, you have to be on top of everything. You have to be super diligent about everything, and you're, you know, hashtag girl bossing your way up the corporate ladder, and then everything stops. And like Marissa and Jenny have pointed out, communication is changed. Your accessibility to executives, to people on your team sometimes have changed. There's a lot of things that become barriers to you actually climbing that corporate ladder. I think it redefines the idea of what a career can and should look like for people. I think people's priorities have changed. And I think when people's priorities change, that affects businesses of any size. You know, 2 years ago, we're not even talking about like 5, 10 years ago. We're talking about 2 years ago. So in 2 years, people have been like gung-ho, wear my sneakers to the office, change into heels. I'm always 100% ready. Like I'm on top of all my stuff to, you know, roll out of bed, put my bunny slippers on and sign on by 10 a.m. if I'm lucky. Like, your perception of work and how it fits into your life is way different now than it was 2 years ago. So I think there's like potential dangers in that of people settling too much into a comfortable work environment where there's no distinction between work and life. But also, like, how do you grow enriching culture for your employees when everybody's kind of like one foot in, one foot out mentality?
Yes. That's an excellent point. And it seems like we've been doing this pandemic thing for centuries. But to your point, it's 2 years. It's, you know, it's 24 months. It's still relatively new, still a lot to learn. And we shouldn't settle into this way of doing things at all. I mean, I kind of think about the education system and how we, you know, kids have to run off to their homes and be educated and take their lessons from there. And that was kind of a panic move. And we had to figure out, you know, the things on the fly, kind of build the plane whilst in the air. Whereas now is a good time to kind of think about things. You know, now we've got a bit of time to breathe and really think about how would we design this if we didn't have to just rush off home in a panic grabbing laptops and monitors? How would we design this hybrid world of work to best suit ourselves? And I say that at an individual level, because that is going to be different for everybody and how that fits into their own life. There were some stats that jumped out to me kind of on that same point about how this can affect people if you don't get a hold of, you know, making sure employees are happy, healthy, and enjoying, you know, working with that company and being part of the culture. One in three women said they considered downshifting or leaving the workforce in 2020. One in four expressed the same the year before that. So that's gone up quite dramatically from a quarter to a third. And 4 in 10 women have also considered leaving their company or switching jobs, according to McKinsey & Company and LeanIn.org's Women in the Workplace study. That is all we have time for this segment. So we're going to move to dinner party data in a second. Thank you so much to my guests. Huge thank you to Marissa.
Thanks, Marcus. Great to be here.
Of course. Yeah, thank you. Thank you to Jenny.
Thank you so much.
And thank you to Victoria.
Thanks, guys.
There she is, ladies and gentlemen. The one and only, the one you've heard so much about, is Victoria. All right, that's all we've got time for from Working From Somewhere. It's time now for Dinner Party Data. The part of the show where we tell you about the most interesting thing that we've learned this week. We start with Peter because he won the game of the week. Peter, what have you learned recently that is interesting to you?
Well, I'm an optimist, but the dinner party data I have today is a bit of a downer. It does tie into some of the things that we talk about.
Way to kick off the new year, Peter.
Yes, I'm sorry.
On a positive note.
I can't be so predictable. And we were just talking about COVID in New York, so I'll continue on that downer note. But Pew Research Center had an article called The State of Online Harassment. It was actually from a year ago, from January 2021, but very relevant still, and probably more so every day. But for this research, Pew conducted a survey of U.S. adults in 2014, 2017, and 2020. For the 2020 survey, they surveyed over 10,000 adults, so a pretty big sample size. And specifically, they were looking at online harassment and looking across the board at different types of harassment that people encounter or experience online. It's unfortunate to see that between 2017 and 2020, there's a pretty big jump across the board in terms of people receiving physical threats, people who say that they have been stalked, sexual harassment, and then things that are classified as less severe, but nonetheless, you know, important to talk about: offensive name calling, purposeful embarrassment, et cetera, et cetera. All of these things were way up from just 3 years ago. But even more startling, I think, with some of this data is that there was no change in the number of people overall that reported online harassment. So, you know, maybe that's okay. It's not going up in terms of overall people experiencing this. But the bad thing is that when you look at the more severe forms, like I mentioned at the beginning, the physical threats, stalking, sexual harassment, those are the ones that experienced a really big increase. So, you know, this is a problem. I know we've talked about it before here, and, you know, how are companies, particularly social media, where a lot of this online harassment happens, how are they going to deal with this? How are they going to reverse this trend so that it starts showing a downward trajectory? You know, all of these things, I think, are really relevant in the conversations on the podcast and in general in the media space.
And just to clarify, these physical threats, harassment, this is all online.
All
still?
Online, yeah.
Okay, exactly. I'd love to see some numbers that show what people...
How it compares to physical bullying and physical... That's the one thing that I was really wondering, because here it says 41%. Experience any online harassment in 2020, it would be interesting to see, you know, is the percent of people who are experiencing bullying in real life or harassment in real life more or less than 41%?
Yes. And is it going up and down by how much? Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't see that in this article. I think this was all focused on online. But I guess what matters here is the upward trajectory.
Yeah,
is not a good sign.
The internet's a horrible place. I don't know why we spend so much time on it. The real world's not great too sometimes, but you can hug people in the real life, in real life, and that's amazing. Can't do that on the internet. At least not yet. Bloody metaverse. Blake, what have you got for us?
So, going off on Peter's data, mine is not not necessarily optimistic. It's not pessimistic. It sort of just is. So YouGov America conducted a poll in mid-December of this year asking, thinking in general about your life in 2022 in comparison to 2021, if you had to guess, do you think that your life will be better, worse, or the same in 2022? So 38% of U.S. adult citizens are optimists. They said, I think my life will be better in 2022. 14% are pessimists. They say they think their life will be worse in 2022, while 48% think that their lives will just be the same as it was in 2021. And that was the largest respondent group, the ones who were neutral. The group who are most optimistic are the under 30 crowd. So 46% of them think that their life will be better. And then that just diminishes as they get older. When you go down to the 65 and older crowd, there's only 28% who believe that their life will be better this year compared to 18% who think that their life will be worse. So, yeah, there you have it. I guess it's nice to be young.
My big question after they say yes to either one, yes, it will be worse or better, is the why. And obviously, like, a lot of people are thinking about the pandemic, but what specifically about the pandemic makes them think that it will be better or worse? I was actually what appears to be now wildly optimistic about this year, because everyone I've spoke to has said it's going to be awful. What's the point? And so I've kind of tried to taper some of my enthusiasm heading into this year, but I'm positive.
I think you've got to stay positive.
Which is rare, because I'm also English.
Yeah.
I think the metaverse, yeah. The metaverse will solve everyone's problems.
Everyone get in quick. Very good. Paul, what you got for us?
Yeah, so Peter cited some audio stats earlier, and Blake has staked out a really important role as like a music person here. So I'm going to take that cue and share some music data that I came across. A friend of mine asked me if anybody still listens to CDs, and my impulse answer was not really, but then I found this great chart that I encourage everyone to look up. It's at RIAA.com. So the RIAA is the Recorded Industry Association of America, and they have this wonderful graph tableau chart, very interactive, of music formats dating back to 1973 and which ones have generated more revenue over the years. So when you look at this, it turns out that 1978 was the high watermark for both the LP and the 8-track. 1990 was the high watermark of the cassette, which, believe it or not, was the predominant format that year. 2000 was the high watermark of the CD before it started dropping. 2012 or 2013, they're tied, was the high point for downloads. And dominant format now is paid subscription streaming. So, you know, if every 10 to 12 years there's sort of like a high watermark, then we would be maybe within a couple of years of the cusp of that. And who knows what will come next.
Fascinating.
If anything.
I thought you were going to cite, so there's some YouGov America data, which I saw. How do consumers listen to music? And the question they asked was, thinking about music, which, if any, of the following have you done in the past 6 months? And they've got a bunch of different countries here. But for the US, listen to music radio in a car, 54%, overwhelmingly number one. Number two, 35% streamed free music online via a service I didn't pay for. Number three, 33% just behind that, stream music online for a service I did pay for. Right behind that, 29%, so 4 points back from streaming. Listen to music on CDs I own. So still around.
Yeah, see, I always have my butler queue up music for me.
How much money are they paying you, Paul? Unbelievable.
You know what else is crazy regarding music sales and the music industry is that the last week of December? It was one of the weeks in December. Vinyl record sales were at its highest level in 30 years. I think it was the week ending December 23rd. Yes. It says 2.11 million vinyl records were sold. And that was, like the most sales in a week in 30 years, which is just amazing. Remarkable.
Vinyl certainly made quite a comeback, but I'm actually predicting that this year people are going to stop buying vinyls and the real music aficionados are going to start going back to 8-tracks.
8-tracks.
It's the only logical progression.
Well, this chart has both. It has revenue, and you can slide the revenue slider to indicate either adjusted for inflation or just straight revenue, but it also has unit sales and it has vinyl broken down by LPs and vinyl singles. So you can actually vet that data that you just cited, Peter, by, you know, just kind of like hovering over that chart and see how many units of each of those was sold this year versus whenever the previous peak was.
Well, the numbers that I was looking at were from Billboard. But yeah, I'm sure that the RIAA will match that pretty closely.
I wonder how many people are buying record players as well. Like, I imagine a good amount of people buying vinyl are listening to it, but there's probably a lot of folks who are just buying it to collect, right?
Hang it on the walls. I would imagine.
Yeah.
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 And it's also like there are a lot of people who are buying reissues, but I live in New York, so like we have a lot of used record stores around, but that also doesn't account for the fact that people buy most of their vinyl used at this point, at least people who are more serious collectors.
Mm. Very nice. I've got one quick one for you. New Year's resolutions. Of course. A UK survey from November found 43% of people will resolve to exercise more and eat more healthily in 2022. According to Statista, 40% plan to lose weight. Around 1 in 5 Brits also plan to spend less time on social media, cut down on alcohol, quit smoking, and reduce their work-related stress. But as we all know, a significant part of the challenge is seeing the resolution through. According to YouGov, around a quarter of UK adults who made a New Year's resolution in 2020 failed to keep any of them. Less than half kept some. So how do you make New Year's resolutions stick? Well, there's actually quite a lot of advice out there. To start with, Jen A. Miller of the New York Times notes that there are 3 signs that your goal for the year might be quote-unquote wrong. 1, it's too vague. 2, the resolution is based on someone else or society telling you to change. Or 3, you don't have a realistic plan for achieving your resolution. BBC Technology of Business reporter Padraig Belton offers a few other ways to improve your chances at keeping up with your resolution. The first one, they cite Brendan Kelly, professor of psychiatry at Trinity College in Dublin. It says, an extraordinary amount of what we do is habit. It is estimated between 45% and 95% of what we do is habitual. And it's more likely to be on the higher end of that, apparently. To get a new habit or change an old one, the change has to be small, ideally be tied to an existing habit, and must be rewarding in the short term. But the professor notes there are apps like Snap Habit, which will help with that. So a new habit is 1. 2, telling people in our lives about our attempts to change a habit can also make us work harder, because then we have people to be friends, family to hold us accountable. 3, the Zeigarnik effect, which I'm pronouncing very wrong, is when we remember incomplete tasks more than ones we've accomplished. So by showing progress bars, percentages, an app can help remind us of our progress. That can help. 4, psychologist Professor Per Carlbring of Stockholm University says, instead of saying that I want to stop eating a candy bar every day, instead say I want to start eating carrots each afternoon. So flipping it on its head. 5, if a 12-month commitment feels like a tall order, CNN's features editor David G. Allen tried setting monthly micro-resolutions, abstaining from particular habits each month, like a dozen back-to-back Lents. 2 more for you. 1 is, it's important to be compassionate to yourself when you fail, trying to take something positive, like an insight about what motivates you. And then finally, reflecting on your past successes. Most people have managed to stick to a resolution at some point in their lives, figuring out what did they do that worked last time. So a bunch of advice. I thought some of it was pretty good, considering my opinion of resolutions is that they pretty much always fail. I thought some of this was pretty helpful. Any resolutions, people?
Nope.
None. Nope. Because they never work.
Sorry, I was just eating a carrot. I couldn't hear.
On that optimistic note of resolutions never working, that's all we've got time for today's first 2022 episode. If you do have resolutions, good luck with them. Maybe some of that advice will help, but more likely than not, it probably won't. Thank you so much to my guests for hanging out. Thank you to Peter, this week's winner of the Game of the Week.
Thank you, Marcus.
Thank you to Paul.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you to Blake.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you to Jenny, Victoria, and Marissa, who joined us for the Working From Somewhere segment. Thank you to Victoria, who edits the show when she's not chatting to us about Working From Somewhere. Thanks to everyone listening. To ask us questions or just say hi, you can email us at podcast@emarketer.com. We'll see you guys hopefully on Monday for the Behind the Numbers Daily and eMarketer podcast made possible by smartly.io. Happy weekends and happy 2022. Give it a week and then it probably won't be.